it's amazing how many people are bringing up McIntyre. You know, I am shocked every time I talk to somebody and they're like, oh yeah, by the way, I'm rereading After Virtue, or I'm reading, you know, another book by McIntyre or something like that. So I think you're definitely right. I think we've moved into a new political moment. You know, both the end of left populism and COVID, I think, have totally changed the kind of world we're in right now. And those of us who are serious about political thinking, I think are no longer thinking in the mode that we were thinking from, you know, say 2013 to 2020, you know?
Yeah, no, I have this thing about when there's political activity to be had, you know, everyone's talking and thinking about politics, talking like just the terminologies like bases and movements and voting and elections and whatever. And then when there aren't any kind of prospects, which was like the case throughout the kind of 2000s and early 2010s, especially, you know, the thinking becomes much more like sociological or philosophical. And we're asking kind of these deep questions. And I think we're kind of back into that.
Yeah, definitely.
All right, hello everyone. Welcome back to BungaCast. Welcome, friends. This is Alex here in São Paulo, Brazil, as usual. I'm joined by George Hoare, fellow Bunga boy. Hello, George. I didn't say hi to you last time, so I'm very conscious of like being. Hey, how's it going, man?
Oh, I'm great. Yeah, great, man. Yeah, thanks for asking. Yeah, it really means a lot. So, thank you. Thanks for not being antisocial and just continuing with your monologue and introducing me.
Sociability is what this is all about today, and we're very happy to also welcome Dustin Dino Guastella, who's a research associate at the Center for Working Class Politics and a director of operations for Teamsters Local 623 in Philadelphia. Dino, it's actually probably pretty belated invitation to have you on BungaCast, but we're happy you're here now.
I'm happy to be here. I'm a fan of the show, and you know, I'm glad to talk with you guys.
So, you know, we're very happy to have you on, and this is also a Damage episode, an episode in partnership with Damage Magazine, a magazine that you've written for a while. And we're going to focus on one of your pieces in issue two, the second print issue of Damage Magazine, which is about drugs, liberalization, social breakdown, focused on Kensington, Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, which we're going to get to in just a second. But I wanted to, because most of our listeners aren't in the U.S., at least half of them aren't in North America, if you could tell us a little bit about the Teamsters, for people who aren't familiar with what that union is and who it represents.
Sure. So we like to say it's America's strongest union. We're one of the largest unions in North America, and we represent primarily drivers and warehouse workers, right? Truck drivers, warehouse workers, package drivers. The name Teamsters, our union was founded in, I think, 1903. The name Teamsters comes from the fact that back then, a person who drove a team of horses was called a Teamster. So once this became mechanized, the, you know, working class kind of ethos behind being a Teamster carried on. And so the name comes from driving a team of horses, even though for most of our history, almost all of our history, it has been driving mechanized vehicles. Right. So it's a very strong union. We are one of the few unions, I think, in North America that is not a part of the AFL-CIO. We left the AFL-CIO sometime in the late 90s, I think. And there's some talks about maybe rejoining the AFL-CIO, but we are an independent union in that sense. And as such, there's a lot of really interesting politics that goes on in the Teamsters. And some of your listeners may have been familiar with the almost strike that we had with UPS, which is our largest single employer, which would have shut down the American economy effectively. So it's a very powerful union. It's a very strong union, and it is a very blue collar union. It's not, not primarily white collar workers, primarily blue collar workers. So, I mean, any other questions you might have, I'll try to answer them. I'm not a Teamsters historian, but I do work for a local Teamsters union here in Philadelphia.
No, I mean, a very contemporary question, which is like, what are the stakes of being or not being affiliated with the AFL-CIO?
The stakes right now, I don't think, are particularly high. I think the choice to leave the AFL-CIO happened at a time when the labor movement was really trying to figure out how to organize, basically. At the time in the 90s, the Teamsters and a few other unions had effectively decided they were going to embark on very large, very expensive organizing campaigns to try to figure out how to break the, you know, deadlock of the fact that we are losing so many workers in the organized labor movement in America. And they formed a new labor association called Change to Win, which embarked on, you know, really ambitious campaigns to try to reorganize the American working class, right? Unfortunately, because so much of this stuff is structural and has to do with the, you know, economic makeup of the society and less to do with certain techniques or strategies in organizing, that effort did not yield the fruits that, you know, many of the unions were hoping it might yield. So we're still, you know, in the doldrums of organized workers. It continues to go down, and we're continuing to see a weakening of the labor movement here. So I think the stakes now are much lower than they were in the 90s, because I think there's a recognition both in the AFL-CIO and in the Teamsters and those other unions that had left the AFL-CIO that we're, you know, this isn't really just about what types of organizing drives you do. This is about a much larger challenge, which is, you know, what the actual structure of employment looks like in the United States. And for that, yeah, I think, you know, most of the labor unions are now in agreement, right? We need a fundamentally different kind of economy, and one that the federal government takes a much heavier hand in sort of steering.
Right, right. No, and I guess, you know, workers in logistics and transport have a leverage there still, which isn't available to other categories of workers, right? I mean, I guess that's something that you can still work with.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you know, the strike for manufacturing workers or for logistics workers is a really, really powerful tool. And these industries have they make a lot of money. They make a lot of profit, right? So you can extract a lot from these companies. It's much harder to do that for, you know, Starbucks baristas, right? Like, no matter how many of them get organized, they just are running up against the structural hurdle, which is each of these little shops doesn't really have a very high profit margin, you know, and there's not much for them to squeeze out of that stone. So I think it is a real challenge of having a service sector based economy and trying to do working class organizing, because there's just this inevitable wall you're going to run into, which is a structural problem, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that raises a whole bunch of fascinating questions about the degree to which workers fight for wages or more autonomy at work and whatever, which would be a fascinating discussion, but maybe for another time, because I guess we have to talk about one of the consequences of deindustrialization. So your piece in Damage in the second print edition of Damage magazine, an excellent piece called Making the Present the Enemy of the Future, centers on Kensington, Philadelphia today. So maybe you could paint us a picture of what Kensington looks like for those who aren't familiar with it. You say that some people call it Zombieland.
And can I just throw in an additional question here? Is it always sunny there? I have to make that reference, because this is, I think, for speaking on behalf of the non-Americans, this is one of the more well-known portrayals of Philadelphia, which feel free to say you never want to talk about it, because everyone's like, oh, Philadelphia,
no,
have you heard of that
great show?
It's great. Or if you actually like it.
It's a great show. And I can't believe it's still on the air. It's been ages.
How it hasn't been canceled or ran out of ideas. So Kensington, this is, I guess, would Paddy's Pub be in Kensington, or would it be in a different area of
No, I think Paddy's Pub is in South Philly, which is near where I live.
Okay.
But Kensington, you know, there could be a Paddy's Pub in Kensington. At least there could have been several years ago. Kensington was historically the industrialized heart of Philadelphia. It was the most industrialized part of the city. At one time, there was something like 75 factories employing more than 100 workers just in that neighborhood alone. Since, obviously, the 1960s, that has been declining and declining and declining, and then really falls off a cliff in the 1990s when we start seeing the massive shedding of manufacturing jobs in that area. Now there are almost, as far as I can tell, I don't think there's a single working factory in the neighborhood. There are these big hulking remnants of what were once very large and active industrial plants. They now are just kind of sitting there empty, idle, and falling apart. The city has not been able to do much to attract investment into the neighborhood. And as a result, the neighborhood has fallen into the kind of void of what is Kensington today, right? Which is to say that it is the single largest open-air drug market in the city, and I think maybe on the East Coast. It is the place with the highest number of overdoses, the place with the highest number of shootings, the place with the highest number of homicides in the city of Philadelphia, which is an already fairly poor and violent city. So it gives you an idea of how much poorer and more violent the neighborhood is. And, you know, for my money, this is all a function of the tremendously destabilizing effects of just ripping the factories out of this neighborhood, which was once a very thriving working class area, and nothing going into that void. You know, it just everything got sucked into that economic void. And the result is what we see today.
There's a place at Kensington in London, which is in a very salubrious part in the southwest of London. So it's a bit of a bit jarring to read about Kenzo. It's like all these £3 million houses and the Natural History Museum. Anyway, sorry, Alex.
There's a story I think about American cities, which I think can be. People would be familiar with this idea, which is like, well, you had kind of great industrial cities. They went through a decline, particularly in the kind of urban core from the 1960s, 70s onwards. But then they kind of were reborn somehow with gentrification, hipsterization of neighborhoods, and so on. And now, generally speaking, it's like the urban core is all kind of pretty and nice with like boutique shops and whatever. And then it's kind of poverty pushed increasingly to the outside. But I'm not sure if the story you tell about Kensington and about Philadelphia entirely fits that. So maybe you can set me straight.
Yeah, I think to a certain extent that is correct. You know, many of the urban cores of, especially the East Coast cities in the United States, have been revitalized in a sense that, you know, many young people starting in the late 80s, going through the 90s, and especially in the early 2000s, started moving into these cities. Young artists, creative types, all of that kind of Richard Florida idea started coming into the cities. The cities started becoming these hubs of these places. And then young professionals obviously started to wanting to live in more walkable kind of social environments. And I do think this is a function of a kind of reaction to the intense antisociality of the suburbs and suburban life for young professionals, right? They were like, they're tired of that. They want to go where the action is. They want to live in a place that feels real, feels more real, you know? And Philadelphia definitely has that character in certain neighborhoods, especially the posher neighborhoods, right? What's interesting about Kensington is that it butts right up against probably the most the poster child for this kind of effect, right? Fishtown is like the equivalent of our, you know, if you're familiar with Williamsburg, Brooklyn or something like that, you know,
right?
It's a formerly working class neighborhood that has just had this tremendous boon in restaurants and bars, and it's become a kind of amazing destination neighborhood. It's very, very expensive now. You know, it's you know, people, houses are going for millions of dollars in Fishtown, which to, you know, friends of mine who grew up in that neighborhood think is absolutely insane, you know, thinking about what Fishtown was in the 1990s compared to what it is today. Well, Fishtown butts right up against Kensington. And so you can stumble out of a bar in Fishtown and find yourself on Kensington Avenue. And I think the, you know, juxtaposition of these two neighborhoods, you know, George, you were talking about Kensington, London and Kensington, Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, Kensington, London, it sounds like, is effectively right next door to Kensington, Philadelphia. It is a very posh neighborhood now. And it's very jarring to see the level of inequality and how, like, absolutely different it is between Fishtown and Kensington. And the plan, it seems like, is just let this naturally play out. The plan, I mean, from the developers, is to just kind of let this naturally play out until there's enough money in Fishtown to push out what's left of Kensington, you know?
Right. Yeah. And all that land would be devalorized, would be cheap to buy up and then redevelop, right? I guess that's the kind of play there.
That's the standard playbook. So just to kind of, because I think in the article you paint the picture really well of this, you know, zombie land, both because of the way the people are potentially leaning due to drugs they might have taken, looking like zombies, and also because it is a kind of an undead place in some ways, perhaps, speaking urbanly, if that's a word. But I guess just to link it back to the title of the second issue of Damage, which is Deinstitutionalized, features, and this sounds like an extended advert for Damage, but you know, I think it all goes together really well with this central idea of psychiatric deinstitutionalization, which is you know, a process which happened in the US and the UK. But I guess my question is, in this part of Philadelphia, what has been deinstitutionalized, or what is the institution or institutions that were there that aren't there now? I mean, it might be quite an obvious question, but it's good to just link it in there, I think.
Yeah. So, you know, being that it was the most industrialized part of the city, it was also probably among the most unionized parts of the city. And Kensington was famous for having very strong unions, tons and tons of little local unions, tons of union halls, lots of social clubs, lots of working class, you know, music halls, things like this. You can still see the remnants of this in Kensington. And I think with deindustrialization, all of those institutions, those kind of medium level civil society institutions, have disappeared. The other deinstitutionalization that I think is significant here is the United States has almost no way to deal with psychosis, public psychosis, or drug use, right? So the only institutional mechanism to deal with this is by locking people up effectively. There is no other way of saying, you know, we're going to get people help, we're going to, you know. And this came out of a process of deinstitutionalization in the 1960s, which had to do with kind of cleaning up the asylums. And the idea was it would be better to have these patients under the care, under community care, under the care of their own families, right?
Yeah.
Well, that was basically code for responsibilizing the public to deal with this problem without the state, right? And the state will just retreat entirely and kind of figure it out. Let's see how this plays out. And it's played out very badly. So I think there are two ways in which deinstitutionalization really has happened in Kensington. The first is getting rid of the institutions of civil society, the working class institutions of political leverage, and the social institutions that sort of made social life possible in the period of industrialization. And the second is the deinstitutionalization of the mentally ill, which means that the state does not have any way to take care of, you know, psychosis, drug-induced psychosis or not. And everybody is just forced to rot in crummy jails if they're going to not rot on the street.
Yeah. No, I mean, it happened in the UK as well. Care in the community ended up being, you know, to oversimplify, a way for the state to kind of take a step back there. But you mentioned drugs a few times, and this is one of the main parts of the article or what you kind of explore, the Portugal solution or the Portugal approach. Is this a kind of non-institutional response to deinstitutionalization? I mean, am I putting that in needlessly complicated ways? Maybe actually what do they do in Portugal with drugs? Could you tell us?
What they were doing in Portugal, which seemed to have been working, was a mixture of needle exchanges, liberalization of, and by liberalization, I really mean the kind of softer touch about public drug use, instead of immediately locking people up, instead of arresting everybody, they were more willing to give fines for drug use. They were more willing to, so they kind of softened the state repressive apparatus, but they ramped yep. up the state's care apparatus. So there was actually a pipeline to get people help. And for a long time, this model was working in Portugal, which was to say, you know, we're going to get you help. But in the meantime, we're not going to, you know, slap you for drug use, right? It's a model that makes total sense. The problem is twofold. One, I think it unleashed a dynamic in which the handing out of the needles and the sort of relaxing of the social mores around drugs and social norms around drugs kind of greased the wheels for the drug market, right? Because now you have a kind of opening for this market to exist, right? Instead of it being a black market, it became a gray market, right? And whenever a market gets a chance to expand, it's going to expand to the greatest degree possible. And so I think it unleashed a dynamic where the drug market starts expanding. We see this in the statistics. There was a rise in hard drug use in Portugal throughout the period of, you know, the early period of the harm reduction stuff. And then what happens is the state's ability to care for these people starts to get very strained. So this is where the title of the article comes from, which is to say that you can say, if resources were not a problem, you can say this is a model that will work. But eventually, you're going to come up against the hard fact that by expanding the population of drug users and expanding the population of addicts, you are going to strain the possibility of rehabilitation for these things on the public purse, right? If the population just keeps expanding, the public are footing the bill, and eventually there's both a political and an economic imperative to say, we got to cut back, right? So what did Portugal do? They cut dramatically on the care side of things, but they kept in place the needle exchanges, the harm reduction, and all of the cheaper ways of dealing with the problem, which just exacerbated it. And the actual architect of this has said repeatedly that this is not, you cannot just decriminalize drugs and hand out needles and think this is going to solve the drug problem. It will make it worse. Despite the fact that he said this, Americans, I think Americans in particular, I'm sure it's happened elsewhere, but Americans in particular, you know, immediately ran with the decriminalization idea. And even though we have no public health mechanism to solve this, I mean, we don't even have a public health system. In Philadelphia, we don't even have a single public hospital. We have no real way to provide drug rehabilitation. So instead, what is happening here is people are saying, well, at least we can prevent people from overdosing. At least we can prevent people from contracting HIV. At least we can do these things. And I understand the impulse there, but I think many people underestimate the effect to which they're greasing the wheels of the drug market and speeding up, accelerating the ability for this market to sort of really get its hooks in that part of the city. And that's what's happened.
For many of us, you know, especially Gen X and millennials who grew up through the war on drugs and all the chaos that caused, that the default response was a libertarian one, right? That, well, people should be allowed to choose what they want to do as a kind of, as a sort of moral principle, and as a more consequential one, looking at the consequences of what the war on drugs has been, both in kind of across Latin America, but also at home in terms of the repression and the increase in mass incarceration, which has now finally kind of peaked and started to decline in the US. That given all that, that, you know, the response has to be legalized. And that was kind of a bit of a mantra, I think, for anybody kind of slightly left of center across the board. And I think what's interesting now is we're in a historical moment, I think, where people are starting to go, well, you know, that's obviously not enough. That in fact, even state authorities have caught on to this more libertarian approach, as you indicate, and realize, well, actually, that isn't the solution that we thought it would be. we're in a weird halfway house where the war on drugs still kind of continues, albeit in much more attenuated fashion. But at the same time, we don't really have a complete reorientation to how we might deal with this with these problems.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sorry, just to jump in there,
I think it comes through in the article that like the it's almost like the mirror image. So the war on drugs is, you know, tough, being really, really tough on drugs. Well, what's the opposite of that? Because the war on drugs has failed so spectacularly, it must be just decriminalize. And I think what you show is that, you know, it just doesn't, it doesn't work. Like either both of those two responses, you know, they have almost kind of mirror image, although the article is not about the war on drugs, they've kind of mirror image problems. Like they don't deal with whatever is the cause of the drug problem. They try and answer it on its own terms. Anyway, I think it's kind of a useful like libertarian and kind of aggressive conservative responses don't really seem to work even on their own terms.
Well, and I think what's interesting about both of them is that they're both, no one ever talks about it in this way, but they're both fiscally cheap responses, right? Like people always forget that.
Yeah.
For a period, I think many people on the left thought, well, you know, this is so expensive. The war on drugs is just so expensive. No, it's actually much cheaper than fixing it the way that we want to fix it, right? Mm. Like a genuinely social democratic response to fixing the drug problem would require way more money than what the war on drugs required, because locking people up is way cheaper than reindustrializing, reorganizing your economy, and providing like a robust, you know, social safety net, or even a robust social system that can provide like the basic necessities of people, right?
Right, and I think it's useful that you say, you know, I want to highlight this, lest it gets kind of, you know, goes under the radar. But you know, the approach that we want, as you put it, it's not just more care for drug addicts, support, etc., help to get back into the job market and stuff like that. You're talking in a, you know, actually reindustrialization, offering jobs, a much broader kind of reform of society than just what is normally spoken about, you know, as the response, which is neither the libertarian nor the conservative one, which is like a little bit more care. And it's like what you're saying is not just the care stuff. It's not just the kind of soft support for those who fall through the net, but actually a much more important restructuring.
Right. And I think the challenge about this is you have to actually have, this goes back to what you were talking about before, Alex, about like the knee-jerk kind of legalize it, right? I think the knee-jerk legalize it response was a moral response to the war on drugs, seeing the war on drugs as being so bad, being like, well, you know, we have to go the other way with this. Unfortunately, I think the unexamined moral shift that happened there was by saying legalize it, you're also saying that drug use is effectively a moral neutral, right? And that the society should be effectively neutral on addiction. And it's up to the individual, it's up to their, you know, what they decide to do and how they decide to live their lives and all this kind of stuff. It's very libertarian. But it's also, I think, mistaken in that there's this idea that there is a set population of drug users, right? It's basically X percentage of the population, right? And if they want to use drugs, like let them do it. It's always going to be that percentage. What this misunderstands is that markets draw people in, right? They will pull people in to this thing. And drug markets especially do this because they actually have a physical, chemical thing that happens to your body that makes you want the drug.
And as social desperation increases, there'll be more, you know, there's the kind of a target market increases as well.
I was going to say, you have to have a moral argument to say, you know, we actually think drug use is bad for the society, you know, to the extent that it exists in America, which is just absolutely phenomenon. And two, how do we actually stop people from wanting to do drugs, right? Not how do we get people off once they're hooked, but how do we actually prevent the drivers of addiction? And I think if you agree with both of those things, you come to very different conclusions than the harm reduction people or the war on drugs people. You have a totally different way of thinking about the problem.
Right. And I mean, it's a testament to a change in social mores, because if we think about the way that advocates for liberalization spoke in the 80s and 90s, it was always perhaps overly defensively, like, we're not in favor of taking drugs. We're just saying that the whole war on drugs is terrible, right? Because of all its negative consequences, both at home and abroad, etc. And now it's slipped into a much more curiously enough, you know, much more like affirmative response, which is like, no, actually drugs are cool too. You like, go ahead and do that. And so that defensiveness is gone. I think the lack of that defensiveness is merely a reflection of the fact that the authorities are more open to kind of liberalization. And then people feel like, well, actually, no, we can say that taking drugs are fine. There's an interesting analogy, I think, even with, and this is a real error that's made, even with sex work or with prostitution, as it was traditionally called, which is that there's an analogy made between kind of recreational drug use, you know, you choosing to do some lines of blow at the weekend, or a, you know, student or whoever deciding to make a little bit of extra money having an OnlyFans versus kind of street corner prostitution or the desperation of drug addicts with little else in their lives. And a kind of analogy that's made, or an elision between those situations, as if it's all the same. It's like, oh, well, it's empowering for me to do this, or it's liberating for me to do this. Therefore, this is something that can apply across society. Hi there, friends. This is the end of a sample from an episode available only to subscribers at patreon.com/bungacast. For $7 a month, subscribers get at least 4 original exclusive episodes a month, featuring Alex, George, and Phil, as well as our regular contributors, Alex Gurevich, Amberly Frost, Catherine New, and Lee Phillips. We've got episodes on current affairs, extended interviews, exclusive episodes on theory, history, culture, docuseries, analyses of film, and our responses to listeners' questions and criticisms. And for $12 a month, you also get access to the very special BungaCast Reading Club, where we present the key books and essays necessary for understanding the world today, how we got here, and where we might be going. Of course, if you just want to try us out, there's also a $3 entry tier giving you one exclusive episode a month. We do hope you'll join us. These are turbulent times, and ideologically confused ones as well. We try to find some political clarity so that we might move beyond the age of Bunga Bunga.